Evolutionary Psychology, Part 1, The Science of Human Nature, Lecture 4, Evolved Psychological Mechanisms.
Now that we've agreed on the criteria that evolutionary biologists use to determine if some characteristic of an organism is adaptive, that is, that it results in increased survival and reproduction, we can now use those criteria to determine if a behavior is adaptive. And so it's time to discuss the central analytic concept of evolutionary psychology, the concept of evolved psychological mechanisms. An evolved psychological mechanism is a behavioral capacity that is either directly or indirectly adaptive, that is, the result of natural or sexual selection. One of the foundational premises of evolutionary psychology is that the mind largely consists of evolved psychological mechanisms, each one performing a particular function in the behavioral repertoire of the organism. We will examine the characteristics of evolved psychological mechanisms in more detail later in this lecture. But let's pause here to consider an example we've already briefly mentioned, suckling. Suckling, that is, nursing on the breast by an infant, is an excellent example of an evolved psychological mechanism. As I pointed out in the previous lecture, the capacity to suckle is clearly an adaptation, as it has resulted from differential survival and reproduction among our mammalian ancestors. Furthermore, suckling also clearly has both innate, that is, inborn, and learned components. All babies with intact nervous systems are born with the capacity to suckle already wired in at birth. However, as any pediatrician can tell you, there is quite a bit of variation in how well babies suckle when starting out, and how well their mothers tolerate them while they learn to get it right. Furthermore, as babies mature and gain experience with the processes of suckling, two things happen. They get better at it, and they learn how to manipulate their mothers, or other caregivers in cultures that have invented artificial nursing, to maximize getting milk and comfort and protection and attention and so forth. And, as you might expect, this process of give and take between infant and mother also involves evolutionary processes and has become an evolved source of conflict between parents and offspring, as first proposed by Robert Trivers. So, what can we conclude from this example? That virtually all significant behaviors, and especially those that are adaptive, involve a combination of innate and learned components. To be more precise, suckling and many other animal and a surprising number of human behaviors involve an innate predisposition to learn particular behaviors. This ability to learn particular behaviors quickly and precisely without straying too far outside of specific parameters defined by the evolutionary adaptiveness of the behavior is what evolved psychological mechanisms are generally all about. That is, much of our behavior is learned, but we learn certain behaviors much more easily than others in specific ecological and social contexts, and often within fairly strict parameters, and especially when such behaviors have significant effects on differential survival and reproduction. The science that I have been referring to in this lecture series as evolutionary psychology has also been referred to as human ethology. In that sense, evolutionary psychologists tend to treat humans as if we were just another species of mammal. Complex, interesting, even paradoxical at times, but not really all that different from chimpanzees African lions, wolves, or even some of the not-quite-so-social social insects. The guiding principle when applying the insights of ethology, that is, the science of animal behavior, to the understanding of human behavior is, once again, that similar causes often produce similar effects. As we will see, knowing something about how behavior has evolved in non-human animals can help us understand how it might have evolved among our own human ancestors. Knowing why other animals do what they do can provide us with some insight into why we do what we do. One of the basic starting points for all ethologists is an assumption that avoids the nature versus nurture trap that has led to so much disagreement between European and American psychologists. This false assumption is that virtually all human behaviors are either innate or learned, but not both. Ethologists, by contrast, assumed that virtually all animal behaviors have both innate and learned components. In general, ethologists are not interested in coming down one way or the other, deciding that the behavior of the animals they're studying are either inborn or learned. Instead, most ethologists are interested in trying to understand how animal behaviors are generated and regulated, and what components of the behavior are modifiable as a result of experience, and what parts are relatively invariant. In particular, ethologists are very interested in how such behaviors develop during the life cycle of an animal, and what the evolutionary and especially adaptive context and ecological context of those behaviors might be. They are, in other words, interested in the constraints that might have shaped the capacity for the behavior over evolutionary time. In almost every case, ethologists try to determine if a behavior makes sense in its ecological and evolutionary context, and how knowing this can be used to formulate predictions about the development and evolution of behavior in similar contexts, albeit among different species, including humans. Now we can define our definition of evolutionary psychology based on the principles of ethology, and consider how it can be studied in more detail. Evolutionary psychology is the discovery and investigation of evolved psychological mechanisms, that is, behavioral and cognitive adaptations using empirical methods. According to David Buss, one of the founders of evolutionary psychology, human evolved psychological mechanisms have several properties in common with the behavioral adaptations of other animals, such as fixed action patterns. According to ethologists, fixed action patterns are complex behaviors that, despite their complexity, appear to be the result of the operation of partially innate physiological mechanisms. Fixed action patterns have several characteristics. Despite their complexity, fixed action patterns are primarily all or none responses to specific stimuli in much the same way as simple reflexes are. Once initiated, a fixed action pattern goes to completion. That is, it continues until the action is finished, even if the original stimulus that triggered it is removed prematurely. Fixed action patterns are highly stereotyped, appearing in very similar contexts and in much the same form in most members of a given species. Fixed action patterns are therefore species-specific. That is, they occur in particular patterns only within particular species. Fixed action patterns can be related to a species' evolutionary history. That is, closely related species exhibit similar fixed action patterns, and in many cases can be shown to be related to similar behaviors in ancestral species, indicating that they have evolved, like anatomical adaptations, by means of natural selection. A classic example of a fixed action pattern is the egg-rolling behavior of the European grey-legged goose, as first described by one of the founders of the science of ethology, Conrad Lorenz. If an egg is dislodged from a goose's nest, the parent, usually the mother, will roll it back into the nest using a stereotyped series of head-wagging movements. The peculiar thing about this behavior is that these movements continue even if the egg is removed, as if the egg were still in place. In other words, once the behavior, egg rolling, is triggered by a specific stimulus, seeing the egg out of the nest, the fixed action pattern of egg rolling the egg back into the nest goes to completion even if the egg is removed. Fixed action patterns are triggered by what are known as signed stimuli, which are very specific cues and events in the environment that an animal can perceive and react to. Signed stimuli are sometimes referred to as releasers, as they release an animal to perform a behavior that it was being driven to perform as a result of internal physiological mechanisms. Signed stimuli are often very restricted, consisting of only one part of the environment sensed by an animal. For example, the signed stimulus for territorial defense by male red-winged blackbirds is the particular shade of red-orange in the plumage of the male's wings. A male red-winged blackbird will go through much of his territorial defense displays when presented with any object of the right reddish-orange color, even a baseball cap worn by a person passing by. Like fixed action patterns, evolved psychological mechanisms are triggered by specific sign stimuli, which release a specific adaptive behavior. Like the sign stimuli that trigger the fixed action patterns in other animals, the sign stimuli that trigger our evolved psychological mechanisms do not necessarily include all of the sensory inputs impinging on us. Rather, our sensory, nervous, and motor systems use a perceptual filter that is biased towards perceiving particular patterns of activity and extracts and enhances these features from our overall sensory input. The degree to which such perceptual filters can be thrown off by random noise, and the degree to which we react to the sign stimuli they detect is directly related to the fitness effects of detecting versus ignoring such inputs. In other words, sensory inputs that increase the fitness of our ancestors are more easily detected and reacted to than sensory inputs that did not. Also, like fixed action patterns, the specific content of the triggering assigned stimuli determines our behavioral response as a result of decision rules wired into our sensory, nervous, and motor systems. And, as in most fixed action patterns, such decision rules are modifiable by experience. What distinguishes us from other animals is not whether the wiring of our sensory, nervous, and motor systems is modifiable as a result of experience, but rather the degree to which they can be modified, especially as the result of cultural learning. As we will see, humans, and to a lesser extent other apes, can learn to react to stimuli via imitation and teaching, that is, learning guided by an experienced individual, as well as by trial and error and operant conditioning, and, we will see that some human behaviors are a lot more like the fixed action patterns of other animals than we might be likely to admit. Finally, the responses that are triggered by such sign stimuli can be behavioral, psychological, physiological, or can trigger other evolved psychological mechanisms. As E.O. Wilson eloquently stated in Sociobiology, the sensory, nervous, and motor systems of a highly social species, such as ourselves, know, or more precisely, have been programmed to perform as if they know, that the underlying genes will be proliferated maximally only if they orchestrate behavioral responses that bring into play an efficient mixture of personal survival, reproduction, and altruism. Such orchestration often involves both behavioral and physiological responses, which nevertheless can be quite complex. Furthermore, since our minds consist of multiple evolved psychological mechanisms, our consciousness is often taxed with ambivalences whenever we encounter stressful situations. As Wilson points out, love joins hate, aggression joins fear, expansiveness withdrawal, and so on, producing behaviors that ultimately either increase or decrease the probability of our survival and reproduction. Those evolved psychological mechanisms that are correlated with increased survival and reproduction become more common over time. We would refer to them as evolutionary adaptations. And those that do not become less common until eventually they disappear. If all evolved psychological mechanisms involve both innate and learned components, why are some more common and easier to acquire and harder to avoid than others? A full answer to that question is not simple. We will attempt to answer it several times during the course of the following lectures. For now, it's enough to say that the ease or difficulty with which an evolved psychological mechanism can be acquired, modified, or lost depends to a large extent on how much of the behavior it produces is conditioned or learned in the behaviorist sense, and how much is hardwired in the sense of an innate fixed action pattern. Learned behaviors can be modified during an individual's lifetime. Indeed, they can be modified multiple times, given sufficient changes in the individual's environment. By contrast, the more hardwired a behavior is, the longer it takes to modify it, because such hardwiring is specified by genes. Changes in genes take many generations. Implicit in this relationship between environment and rate of modification of behavior is the rate of change in the environment compared with the lifespan of the organism reacting to such changes. Animals that live only a very short time generally do not experience very significant changes in their environment. Therefore, there are relatively few circumstances in which their behaviors need to be modified, and so much of the behavior of such organisms is hardwired, and therefore not particularly modifiable via learning. Animals that live a relatively long time are much more likely to experience significant changes in their environments. And therefore, natural selection tends to result in evolved psychological mechanisms that are more or less modifiable as the result of learning. Humans are among the most long-lived of all animals, and so it should not be surprising that a significant number of our evolved psychological mechanisms are modifiable as the result of learning. On the other hand, if what is evolving in us is the capacity to modify our behavior in particular ways, the evolution of such capacities, paradoxically, can take much longer than to rewire a mostly innate behavior. The wider the parameters that constrain learning as part of an evolved psychological mechanism, the longer it takes to modify those parameters. This is because the feedback from the effects of mostly learned behaviors is less direct. We can think of it as being more diffuse than the feedback from mostly innate behaviors. That is, the more flexible a response because of learning, the less direct its effects on the underlying genes that code for the wiring that produces such learned behavior. This means that as our behavior has become more modifiable through learning, the underlying capacities for such learning have changed more slowly over deep evolutionary time. Lita Cosmides and John Tooby, two of the founders of evolutionary psychology, have captured these relationships in their primer on evolutionary psychology, in which they outline the salient characteristics of evolved psychological mechanisms. First of all, evolved psychological mechanisms are properties of our sensory, nervous, and motor systems, which can be considered to be computers that are wired in such a way as to generate adaptive behavior in specific environmental circumstances. Again, this does not mean that our behaviors are hardwired and therefore unmodifiable. However, it does imply that the underlying capacities to learn certain kinds of behaviors are at least partially innate, and therefore may take many generations of selection to change. Our sensory, nervous, and neuromuscular wiring, and therefore the behavioral outputs of our evolved psychological mechanisms, have been shaped by differential survival and reproduction in our evolutionary past. Evolutionary biologists often refer to the evolutionary environment of adaptation, sometimes referred to as the EEA, in which adaptations evolve, and which therefore shape such adaptations. This means that adaptations are specific to particular evolutionary environments of adaptation. They are only adaptive in the context of the evolutionary context in which they have evolved, and may be neutral or even maladaptive in other contexts. Much of the activity of the nervous system in producing evolved psychological mechanisms is unconscious and appears to be very simple and straightforward. For example, most people can easily tell if an action is being produced by an intentional agent. Indeed, this ability first appears in infants only a few months old. However, programming a computer to detect agency is extraordinarily difficult. Even the most powerful supercomputers cannot do so as easily or reliably as an infant. At least they can't yet. Such apparent simplicity is often misleading. Most evolved psychological mechanisms require complex computation using multiple decision rules which are wired into our nervous systems. We will see many examples of such fiendish simplicity in later lectures. As you may expect, one of the salient characteristics of many evolved psychological mechanisms is that they employ feature extraction in much the same way as fixed action patterns react to specific, easily and unambiguously sensed sign stimuli. Different neural circuits have become specialized for producing specific evolved psychological mechanisms under specific environmental conditions, a condition sometimes referred to as massive modularity. Again, as the earlier quote from E.O. Wilson suggests, the activities of these mental modules are not necessarily coordinated nor congruent. Indeed, much of the complexity of human behavior stems from the competing demands of modules that have evolved with very different decision rules. We perceive ourselves as single individuals. But our underlying minds are actually a confederacy of mental modules which sometimes cooperate, sometimes compete, and often operate without knowing or reacting to the outcomes produced by other mental modules. We know this because of detailed psychological testing into the structure and function of human nervous systems done over the past 20 or 30 years. What has come out of those studies is what we could call the confederacy of modules model of the human mind, which once again means that we are not one thing, but actually many. We are, in other words, many evolved psychological mechanisms. Finally, our modern skulls house a Stone Age mind. Many evolved psychological mechanisms were shaped by natural and sexual selection in specific environments in the distant past, and therefore may not be adaptive today. As we will see, this has implications for many humanistic endeavors, including aesthetics, ethics, and the concept of free will. It also means that if we decide that certain evolved psychological mechanisms are no longer desirable, we may have to hoodwink them into reacting to new environments as if they were the same ones in which they originally evolved. If all of this sounds very different from what you thought you knew about human behavior, you're not alone. Most of the concepts that I've outlined in this lecture run directly counter to the dominant theories of human psychology as they have developed over the past century, and especially in America. In the next lecture, we will talk about that other dominant theory, what many evolutionary psychologists refer to as the standard social science model, and what evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker calls the blank slate. We will see how and why the blank slate model was originally developed by American social scientists, and how it affected the kinds of behaviors they paid attention to, and which ones they discounted, ignored, or explained away. We will also see what new observations have forced a general re-evaluation of the blank slate model of human behavior, and why evolutionary psychology provides the most natural replacement for it. A question to think about is, why did American psychologists assume that all significant behaviors, especially all significant behaviors in humans, are purely learned? It's an interesting question because European psychologists did not make this assumption. Furthermore, the direction in which European psychologists took their version of psychology was very, very different from the direction in which American psychologists took psychology. Why did this divergence occur? And why now, with the development of evolutionary psychology, are we finally beginning to see that there is a common middle ground between these two models of human psychology?
This ends Lecture 4. Remember to visit this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll find additional information about the lectures you just heard.